A delegation of church leaders from Europe, the United States and a number of developing nations were received by Pope Benedict in the Vatican on Friday as part of their campaign to keep development issues at the top of the agenda for next month's G8 summit in Germany. The cardinals and bishops from Honduras, Nigeria, India, the Democratic Republic of Congo, the United States, Germany, France, Italy and Scotland were encouraged by the Pope to continue campaigning for the welfare of all people all over the world. Last week, the church leaders visited British Prime Minister Tony Blair, German Chancellor Angela Merkel and Italian Prime Minister Romano Prodi, urging them to keep their promises already made to poor countries in terms of increased aid, debt reduction and fairer trade regulations. The lobbying comes as part of an international Catholic campaign coordinated by the Worldwide Caritas Confederation and by CIDSE, an alliance of Catholic development agencies from Europe and North America. But just how much power do these bishops and cardinals have to persuade the GH leaders to take action on behalf of the poorest people in the world? A question I put to Nigerian Archbishop John Onaiyekin after his meeting with the Pope.
First of all, it is like sowing a seed. And, you know, when you sow a seed, first, you don't expect every grain to germinate. Secondly, you don't expect it to bear fruit immediately. But at the end of the day, we believe that it will be a worthwhile venture. From our discussion with the various people that we met, the majority of them showed very keen interest in what we were saying. Many of them have not had such a group visiting them in their office before. And they're sort of inquisitive and genuinely interested in the things they are hearing from us. May I add, too, that to those of us from the so-called poor countries, for them, this is a different kind of language from what they normally get from our leaders with whom they hobnob in the international fora.
You're optimistic, then, perhaps, that at the G8 summit there will be some progress. You're asking them mainly to live up to the promises they've made before, aren't you? You're not actually asking for very much in the way of new actions.
Well, we're optimistic because already the G8 has included among the two main overarching themes Africa, which means the problems of the continent of Africa and by extension, the problems of the poor all over the world will receive very definite attention. But like I said too, we have had opportunity to alert them to the fact that promises have not been kept. Some of them, and I'm not going to mention name, actually said that one head of government said, "I'm ashamed that my government has not yet met its commitment."
Can you tell us who that was?
No, I will not tell you who that was. But just to let you know that our presence challenged him and provoked him to shame. If he's ashamed, I'm sure he will do something about it.
You're actually calling for a change in structures, aren't you? You believe that this goes deeper than just allotting a little bit more aid, perhaps, to the developing world.
Yeah, I'm reminding ourselves that what we are asking for really are palliative measures. After all, the Millennium Development Goals are saying that they want to reduce poverty by half by the year 2015. They are not talking about eliminating poverty. Just reducing poverty, not just poverty, abject poverty, by half. The question is, even after the Millennium Goals have been achieved, the world will still be a very unequal and consequently a very unsafe and insecure place. Therefore, we ought to be thinking beyond simply 0.7 here, 2.6 here, and we have to begin to look at this world that God has now given us. And I'd like to say that, from looking at it from a theological point of view, it seems for the first time in the history of humanity, the desire of God that all human beings should be one family is now technically feasible. It's already happening technologically. What we now need is a political will to make it happen. There was a time, I imagine, since we are talking in Italy now, there was a time when the rich people maybe out in Milan didn't care at all what happened to the poor people in Sardinia or in Sicilia. Now they do, because they are within the same country. And even it has gone further that the rich economies of Germany and England that were there when I was a student here, and when Italians were going as immigrants to go and as Gastarbeiter in Germany, they have now broadened it so that the whole of Europe is coming together, integrating. And the beautiful thing is that the more you broaden your mind and integrate, the more is good for everybody. Now, this can't just stop with Europe or even with the G8. And if anybody is thinking that it will stop, they better wake up to the fact that we are in one world and it's no longer possible to create your little oasis of affluence in this desert of want. And we are saying it is possible. And not only that is possible, that when that happens, it will be a win-win situation for everybody concerned. And we could say then, even if we do not abolish poverty altogether from the world, our humanity will have a better chance of safety, peace, and tranquility.
But it's not just the G8 leaders who are being called to task by this delegation. The campaign is entitled Make Aid Work, The World Can't Wait, and it's calling on governments in both rich and poor countries to live up to their election promises on behalf of the poor. Many Western leaders still claim there's no point increasing aid to developing countries unless they can improve standards of democracy, transparency and good governance. Archbishop Onayekin again.
Naturally, while we're talking with them, since they always include among the items of discussion, among the conditions for increased aid, the problem of corruption, bad governance, lack of democracy, obviously they start talking about us. Obviously, we who come from the poor countries, are constantly embarrassed. We're not embarrassed about our poverty, because poverty in itself may not be your fault. But when you have a situation where the resources of the nation is very badly administered, and when there is massive corruption in which a few people steal whatever little resources is available, and when those people who put themselves in power refuse to go and refuse to allow the people to choose their leaders, then we say there's something wrong. Now, this is linked up with our lobby, because we've had the opportunity then to tell the rich countries that, look, you have been doing business with corrupt governments all across our nations, and maybe your business people sometimes feel more comfortable dealing with corrupt rulers. All they need to do is pay a few bribes here and there instead of dealing in a correct and just exchange of, trade relationship. It's probably cheaper to bribe a corrupt ruler than to pay the proper taxes. But this is short-sightedness, we are saying. It's just short-sightedness, because on the long run, it will be better for everybody if we have decent relationship between the poor countries and the rich countries. And in fact, it would be better if there were no poor countries anymore. After all, the G8 among themselves have got very good relationship in terms of trade. And their exchange of trade is making their own wealth grow. Let us be rich too, so that the world may be richer.
What about the message to your own government? The situation in Nigeria following the elections?
My government already knows what we thought about the elections, because we spoke from the authoritative standpoint of a church that deployed 30,000 young men and women to all the polling booths in the Federation. And when we came out with our conclusion that the elections in most of the places was not credible, we were saying so from position of knowledge of the fact. And at the Bishops' Conference, under the leadership of Archbishop Felix Alaba Job, has already said this. But if you ask, what is our suggestion of the way forward? Say, first of all, we must try and recover the truth. There's no point pretending that everything went well when the whole world has seen the shame we made of ourselves. Therefore, the government that organized the election should be ready to say, we are sorry. And in any case, they canceled some of the elections and redid it. Although the time they did it again, people had lost confidence in the whole system and were told that it was massive voter apathy, to such an extent that you can say less than 20% of voters went to the polling booth. Of course, that does not mean that the results didn't show that 90% voted. But that's part of the problem. So the Bishops' Conference of Nigeria has already come out very clearly. So we said the way forward, first, if you do not admit that there's something wrong, we will never take steps to improve it. Secondly, we believe that everything should be done to avoid chaos. And so confrontational attitude between the presumed winners and the aggrieved losers should be, as far as possible, toned down for the sake of the people. And thirdly, the government itself and Obasanjo himself has said that those who are aggrieved should go to the tribunals. And we are saying this is a civilized way of addressing the issue, provided the government also creates the condition for such tribunals to work correctly, and above all, work promptly. Because last time, a governorship election that was rigged, I mean, the judgment did not come until 3 years into the term of 4 years, at the end of which the court decided that the person who had been ruling for 3 years was never really elected. The person who won is Mr. X. And Mr. X came with only 1 year of mandate. This is a classical case of justice delayed is justice denied.
And my thanks there to Archbishop John Onaiyekin of Nigeria, part of the delegation visiting G8 leaders last week on behalf of the campaign Make Aid Work, The World Can't Wait.